I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Lynn Abraham was a judge in Philadelphia for 15 years and later served as the city's district attorney for 19 years. After a few years out of the public eye, she has decided to run for mayor of Philadelphia, a city where she was born and raised. She graduated from Germantown High School and was the first member of her family to go to college. She was one of just two women to graduate from Temple University Law School. She joined us on Radio Times to talk about what she would do if elected the next mayor. And while Philadelphia has a lot going for it, the city's stubborn poverty rate is stuck at about 25%. Its school system has faced a series of crippling budget crises, and the city needs to be more job-friendly. This is just the first of a series of sit-downs with the candidates vying to be the Democratic nominee for mayor of Philadelphia. Lynn Abraham, nice to have you with us, back with us on Radio Times.
Always a joy, Marty. Thank you so much
You're
for inviting
welcome.
Me.
You're very welcome. How important is your gender to your candidacy? You told one of my colleagues, women have real power, and this is their opportunity to exercise it.
I'm running as a candidate for mayor, who also happens to be a female. I believe that this is ripe in our history. In 334 years of leadership in Philadelphia, there's never been a woman elected any kind of leader or having a major leadership role. And I believe that the perspective that women bring, as well as my experience and all the other gifts that I believe that I have acquired and learned and have, lead me on a path of leadership, which I think the city sorely needs. It doesn't make me more qualified to be a leader. It's just the fact that it's long overdue that women take their rightful place in the highest ranks of business in the community and in electoral office.
Do you think there are women's issues in this city and men's issues in this city?
I think, yes, I do. I think that, for example, one of the you and I were talking a few moments ago about all the forums that the candidates have attended. And of all the forums that I have attended, there hasn't been one on women's issues, such as family violence and sexual assault, domestic violence issues, equal pay for equal work, what's happening with women in the community, how they exist on shelters, what job opportunities are foreclosed for them, educational opportunities, and the like. And I've pledged as part of my platform to have a women's department or division, not necessarily a cabinet level, but those people who are interested in making sure that women and families, three generations, women, their children, and their parents, have the kinds of services and access to all the things that they need, quality care, services, being part of the discussion. Women have been bypassed in almost all of these major discussions. It is totally shocking.
Well, why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think mostly because they haven't really thought about it, or they haven't done anything on the elderly or the homeless or the other issues either. I mean, we've touched upon elderly and poverty tangentially, but you know, the whole panoply of things, what happens to our older citizens in Philadelphia, of which we have many.
Yes, we do.
When the families leave, and the poverty level, the hunger, the privation, the loneliness, and the issues of aging and aging in place and otherwise, these are two issues that have been fairly well pushed off to the side. And I understand that there are important issues of Philadelphia that we all are facing. But those are things that I thought deserved more than a passing reference.
Well, one of the issues that I know that you and the other candidates have talked about, and frankly probably is the number one issue facing the city, is the school system, the quality of the schools, and also the fact that it has had so many budget crises over the last couple of years. Mayor Nutter has proposed increasing the property tax. Superintendent Hyde has said we need $103 million in order to really make the schools as functional as he wants them. What do you suggest? How do you suggest the school system, the next mayor, maybe city council, get more money for the schools?
I think in this, there's both a short-term and a long-term objective here. The governor has proposed in his present budget, which he says he will miss enforcing by June the 30th. We'll see that mature
as things.
At least
has to deal with Harrisburg.
Oh, it certainly does. But and obviously he has proposed funding for our schools, which do two things. Not only pump up the economy devoted just to schooling across Pennsylvania, including a per capita allotment for every child in Pennsylvania, because there are many other children in Pennsylvania, but Philadelphia has the biggest problem. He's going to propose taxes that will alleviate property taxes in Philadelphia, but still provide funding for going forward, plus filling the hole that was created by children transitioning out of the Philadelphia public school system into charter schools, which and took the funding with them, with leaving the big hole in the public school budget. So, but the problem is when that's going to be implemented. Shorter term, we might have to look at a variety of things that we're going to have to do to plug that gap until the governor's funding
Such
formula
as.
Goes in. Well, I have suggested having a roundtable of stakeholders to see how we can reform some of our taxes. And obviously there's a variety of interest at play. However, one of the things that has been bandied about is a constitutional amendment by the other candidates to change the way we tax commercial real estate from residential. And I am of the opinion that Harrisburg is not going to change that coupling of residential and commercial. So I've said, look, without trying to get through Harrisburg a constitutional amendment, which is no small feat, and constitutions are amended very reluctantly and not very often, we take a look at whether we can decouple for Philadelphia the property taxes. Excuse me, the property taxes from commercial and residential, just decouple them and do it on a basis where business would be willing to change the tax structure for commercial properties, have a higher tax structure for commercial properties by about 15%. But that money goes to reducing wage taxes and reduces their business taxes to increase in inward migration of people, which avoid coming to Philadelphia for a tax structure and thereby grow our economy. Mm. In addition to that, I've proposed various ways to secure funding on a short-term basis by, for example, collecting outstanding arrearages that are owed, but that's going to be also a tough slog, making efficiencies in economies. And essentially everything's going to be on the table because one cannot close our eyes to the realities of the way we spend our money and have our money. The question is going to be, what is that picture going to look at? But I do not, and I have said this, and I know the mayor has made comments about all the candidates.
In fact, he calls all the plans bogus.
Well, I understand that's his opinion as an outgoing mayor, but I think that the real problem for Philadelphia is that the residents of Philadelphia, many of whom are older, many of whom are just hanging on to what they believe is the middle class, no matter mm-hmm. what others, mm-hmm. Economists may say, they feel and are frightened about the fact that they had a 11% tax increase, 10 or 11% in 2011. Then they had the AVI increase in taxes for many. Now they're going to be facing another 9.4% tax. And this is a crushing and a regressive tax. This is not going to work. Now, what city council and the mayor do about it in Philadelphia, we'll just have to wait and see, because that's not going to wait for the next mayor. That's going to be in this mayor's
indeed.
Budget.
But it sounds like you're depending on Governor Wolf to get his budget proposal through the legislature. That is not a done deal, and he's getting a lot of pushback on that.
Yep.
And also depending on some agreements within this city that also seem like they're pretty difficult in order to get some changes in the tax structure to get more money for the schools.
I don't think. Look at it this way. Philadelphia has been traditionally cheated out of its proportional share of educational funding for years, even decades. It's time that some governor recognizes that right. Philadelphia deserves a per capita fair funding formula for every single child.
But it looks like this governor does.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things that Governor Wolf, I believe, as a businessman and as a very bright man as our governor, and I think he sees the fact that everybody else sees. We cannot afford to kill the economy of this Commonwealth and especially the city of Philadelphia by failing to do what the right. state is obligated to do, and that's fund education at a level that is sustainable, that is continuing, that is fair, and it's proportional to all of our children.
But that's an argument to the legislature, though,
isn't it? I believe the governor is going to put a compelling case, and even our legislators know that this is not something that the governor wants because it's something that he wants to give, make himself a gift and say, I'm a great fellow. Every legislator knows across the length and breadth of this Commonwealth that our children are failing. Our graduation rate, our job creation rate, everything is failing. Legislators understand that because people vote. And I believe that whatever arrangements have to be made between the legislative bodies in Pennsylvania and the governor, they will be, even if he has to trade off some things in order to get it.
You have called for a moratorium on charter schools. And at the same time, we see that there's a waiting list to get into charter schools in this city. Whether critics like it or not, parents are looking to charter schools as a place to send their children. How do you reconcile those two?
I do. And I'll tell you what, my plan was not a moratorium on charter schools per se. It was a moratorium on charter schools until not only the next governor was elected, but the next mayor was elected. Unfortunately, as we have seen, five more charters opened. I do not quarrel with families, all of the families, who want a better education for our children. I believe the way to handle it is by our school superintendent Height's plan to sort of blend our public schools and our charter schools. You know, charter schools, for all of the some of the benefits that they provide, are failing. Many of them are failing, and they're doing no better a job than Philadelphia public schools are. Now, there are notable exceptions in both our public school system and our charter school system, but many of them are failing. Many of them are for profit. They're not doing well. They're being closed. There's an article in the paper today that the legislature is threatening to take over failing schools throughout Pennsylvania. And that means that the legislature that we just spoke about knows, as I mentioned, that our schools are failing our children, and they cannot and will not allow that to happen. So I believe that parents do want school choice. I support that choice. Mm. It is not for me a matter of public versus charter. It's both. It doesn't make any difference. Whoever educates our children the best, they deserve the kinds of support, and I think that I can give them, and that blending charter and public schools is not really an issue. It's all about the children, not the name of the school he or she or they go to.
When you say school choice, does that mean school choice in the
not the vouchers.
Okay, well, I was going to say, because school choice is often associated with vouchers.
No, I'm not talking about vouchers. I believe that charter and public schools, I'm not looking to privatize the school system. But you know, you said parents want a choice.
They do.
Well, that's what I'm just using the word that you use. I'm not talking about, quote, school choice, end quote. I'm talking about whether it's public, parochial, charter, private schools, all have a role to play. But with regard to the people of Philadelphia who either go to public schools or wait or are going to charter schools, for me, that's not the issue. The issue is it's all about the children and putting children first. What the name of the school is, charter versus public, is not the question. It's who is best able to provide our children with the best education, and charter providers and public school providers are failing. So therefore, it's not a matter of teaching. It's teaching and results oriented, and holding principals and teachers, especially teachers, accountable for results.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. The first of what will be six interviews with the six Democrats running for mayor of Philadelphia. The primary is on May 19th, just about a month away. And joining us in this hour of Radio Times is Lynn Abraham. She has a long track record here in Philadelphia, grew up in Philadelphia, a judge for 15 years. She was the district attorney for 19 years. We're going to take a very short break. We've already got a lot of comments coming in. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. There are six Democrats running for mayor of Philadelphia this year, and you will be hearing from each of them over the next week or so, beginning our conversation with Lynn Abraham, who joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And you can join us as well by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. In many ways, Philadelphia really is a tale of two cities. And you look at downtown, even the sort of larger expanded center city, and you see prosperity, and you see new buildings, and you see people on bicycles and jobs, and I would say a very prosperous, vibrant city. Not too far away from that, you've got a 25% poverty rate, and many children in the city growing up in poverty.
Indeed.
How do you suggest addressing that? And this is a long-standing problem.
Yes. Obviously, not only have we cheated our children out of first-class education and pre-K and services and the kinds of social and emotional well-being, but we've really cheated ourselves out of 400,000 of us not being productive working citizens, invested in their community, their neighborhoods, and able to enjoy the great benefits of the city. You know, I've been to many places of the city which are very, very, very deeply in poverty. And I'm standing on these places and I can see the buildings of Center City. And
the Emerald City.
It really is. It's like it's there, but I can't get there. And I think often of how the folks who live in that community are looking at this and saying, this is not for me. I'll never be out of this neighborhood, and I'll never be able to enjoy that part of life right here.
And but what does a mayor do about
that? A mayor has to have a strong desire to change the level of poverty. And to do that, we have to change our resources. So in order to do that with the limited monies we have in our budget, and our budget is really a tight budget, with everybody justifiably making demands on the budget for their needs. And they're all legitimate and they're all worthy. But what you have to do first is set a standard of priorities. So our first priority, obviously, is education. That is the single thing which separates everything from everything else. If you have a good job, you have a good economy, you have working, happy families who are producing, who are running up the socioeconomic ladder, who are healthy, who are better off, and they're producing. And I can tell you that one of the things about poverty, and this is a very – look, we've had the war on poverty since Lyndon Baines Johnson declared it, and trillions of dollars poured into it, and there's virtually no difference in where people are across the length of this country in terms of poverty. So we must try as hard as we can with all the spirit that got us here to start thinking about how can we jam a wedge in the revolving door of familial poverty. One of those best ways is to I believe that one of the best ways we can help get people out of poverty is be realistic about how we can educate those adults who are seeking opportunities. And I think there's been too little attention paid to adult literacy and education and job training. We've concentrated, and with good reason, on the next generation or generations. But while we're not serving them well, we can't serve them well as a whole if when they go home to their families, their moms and dads can't help them because their moms and dads are illiterate or suffer from other issues. But we certainly can make sure that the literacy of adults, really adult education, and even I've thought about having adults and children go to education in the same building because our buildings are underutilized, and have adult education at the same time kids are going to be educated. So for those families who are not otherwise employed, obviously if you have a mom or dad who's working, then you have to tailor their educational attainment at different times. It is a difficult, hard slog. The mayor's present mayor's initiative on literacy is going along, but it doesn't reach far enough. I think that job training, you don't have to be extraordinarily well educated to have a good job. It's the training and the time, and therefore leveraging unions, businesses, travel and tourism industries, and all the other industries of Philadelphia to have as their program pilot projects of integrating those people who really, really want to work. And you advertise a job. There may be 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 people standing outside because they want to work. And it doesn't have to be the kind of skills that are all just technologically based. There are jobs, especially but not limited, in travel and tourism, hospitality industry.
What about a living wage?
Well, living wage is extremely important. The question is how to make sure that the people get a living wage that they can survive on. And the governor has pegged that for today at what he believes is $10.10. That probably is not nearly enough.
I don't think it's a living wage in Philadelphia.
It's not a living wage almost anywhere. But that the state sets the standard, and you've seen recently what happened when the city tried to raise its hourly wage, and the state is taking some action. We don't know where that will go. But probably $15 to $17 an hour is likely to be the living wage. This is going to be a tremendous push against business interests, and there's going to be a lot of pushback. But If we're going to lift people out of poverty and really make a difference and also make sure that we're not draining public coffers on supporting those families with monies out of the general treasury that could be better used for education and other services a city should deliver, we just have to. We just must recognize that people have to live in dignity. They don't have to live in squalor. When they come home from a 40-hour work week, they shouldn't have to worry about do they turn on the gas or has the gas been shut off because they had to buy groceries or vice versa. There shouldn't be a trade-off. This is not high living, folks. This is just day-to-day living, not an existence, but a living. And that's – I support that entirely.
Well, let me – and I'm putting a bunch of issues on the table. Each one of them could be an hour, but let me put something else on the table here, which is Mayor Nutter's efforts. And frankly, I think some success is making Philadelphia a green or greener city. How do you reconcile that with this idea for the energy hub? And while the energy hub certainly represents jobs and perhaps some of these good-paying jobs that we have been talking about, there are concerns about risks of train derailments, about the risks of pipeline problems, methane leaks, things like that.
Sure.
As a mayor, where would you stand on reconciling these two issues?
I think we have 10,000 acres of parks and parklands and squares, and trails, and others. I don't believe that you have to have one or the other. I think that the technology is there, the will is there, the ability is there. And we've had oil and gas going through our pipelines already in the ground for quite some time, fortunately. And the trains are regulated by the federal government, not by state governments. But fortunately, the EPA, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, and the federal governments are changing the rules of railroads, especially the federal government, with railroad safety, speed limits, redesign, retrofitting of rail cars. And so as long as we have the will, and I believe we must do this, be independent as an energy producer so that we're not suffering at the hands of, I don't know, Boko Haram taking over the Nigerian countryside and maybe disrupting the flow of oil from there or more upheaval in the Middle East. We must be energy independent. So if you're going to step down from coal and get away from a carbon footprint like big time, the better way is gas as opposed to even oil. But right now, pipelines that go through Philadelphia. So I believe we can have an energy hub. We can have thousands of good-paying jobs, good construction jobs, which will put some of our men and women to work at the construction jobs and permanent jobs. And we can balance both the environmental interest, of which I am vitally concerned, and support the Green Cities Clean Waters initiatives, and also make jobs and the economy grow. I mean, you don't have to put one against the other. We have proven that it can be done. And there are going to be lots of protections and oversight to make sure that we minimize, if not eliminate, those risks. You can't eliminate every risk in life. But you can certainly make sure that the infrastructure is right, the pipelines are maintained, that there are safety checks and other devices that can make sure that we have an uninterrupted flow of natural gas from the Marcellus, whatever oil comes through from the Dakotas, that it's exported, it's refined, it's used here, it builds other businesses and industries, petrochemicals and other industries that rely on natural gas and so forth. And natural gas is going to be the coming thing.
And that's Lynn Abraham, one of the Democrats running for mayor of Philadelphia. The first of a bunch of interviews we're going to do with each of these candidates in anticipation of the Pennsylvania primary, which is on May 19th. We do have some calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I also see lots of comments as well, and I will get to those. Radiotimes at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Let me ask you about police-community relations. Mm-hmm. And Commissioner Ramsey asked the federal government to really investigate the potential problems or what turned out to be some problems in training for Philadelphia police officers, also coming to the conclusion that there is a tension, conflict, if I can put it that way, between the police and many of the people in the community whose job it is they are to serve and protect. How do you suggest addressing the problems between police and community, knowing, of course, this is a national issue?
Certainly. The commissioner is to be commended for requesting because he saw the problems. He didn't see potential problems. He saw the problems. He's a very good police commissioner. Solid.
If mayor?
Of course. If he wanted to stay. I mean, and I'm not so sure that that is on his agenda, but I'll find out. After the 19th of May, if I win the favor of the voters, I will certainly call him within the first day after that and find out. I want to know what he thinks. It's not what I would think. It's really a combination of what he and I are both thinking. However, I know he knew these things exist because I knew they existed. The question is, I believe that most police officers really want to serve, protect, and do their jobs with integrity. However, I believe there's a tremendous potential for improving how we police, modern technology, you know, the way we've always done it, the status quo, as I call it, is never good enough. We're moving ahead. We have to have 21st century policing, 21st century technology, better training, integration of those better training protocols into the policing, putting in cameras into the cars, and establishing, or perhaps in many cases, reestablishing a bond of trust and communication between the police and the community.
How do you do that?
This takes a tremendous amount of rubber meets the road kind of diplomacy. It's like going back and forth in international diplomacy. The police department, the police officers in a given community must get to know and understand the culture of a community, the various diverse elements of that community, how to properly interact with people, how to do their jobs but do it in a way that is not offensive or appears to be like an invading army. Speaking to people, have the people in the community get to know them.
But isn't this what community policing was supposed to be about?
It was, but what happened, it was pretty much put on the back burner. While it was out there at a very, very high level, police-community relations improved because the community was being consulted by the captains, the lieutenant, the police community relations officers, and the officers themselves. And people would come and interact with the police to suggest ways in which the police could do this better, police could do that better. But in some communities where that bond of communication and trust broke down, and where the police felt that it was the, quote, us against them, quote, mentality, that just means that the police were not of the community, they were the other. And both the community and the police felt estranged and acted in ways that were inappropriate. So the use of deadly force, the use of excessive force, whether it was deadly or not, the inability of an officer to understand how to interact with people, how to speak with dignity and respect but still do their job, not to use offensive language in dealing with members of the community, not to curse or swear at people. Also, conflict de-escalation and resolution, trying to bring people together so that the community operates as a – not as a police officer but as a helping, suggesting group of people who help the police do a better job. I believe this is doable if we change the mindset slowly, carefully, and rebuild and re-knit that fabric of the community. This can return because people do call the police. When they get in trouble, the first thing they do is dial 911 and say, I need a police officer. When that police officer responds, he or she should be looked upon by the community as, oh, thank God, Marty Moss Cohen just showed up. She's a great police officer. She'll help me. And that's the way they have to not, oh, my God, it's her again. Well, don't talk to her. She's not trustworthy. She's mean. She treats us with dismissive and disrespectful words and actions. This will never work. This will never work if we don't change and make sure our police officers are respectful, well-trained, culturally sensitive, and being a part of the community.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. We have Frank calling us from Center City, Philadelphia. Frank, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to point out the undue influence of campaign finance in the city for the first time. Lots of money over, I don't know, several million dollars. In one particular group right outside the city in Montgomery County who are obviously targeting the school system, and I guess, although I'm not sure, they're probably more in favor of charter schools, but I can't say that for sure. But they are wielding an undue influence in the city's handling of its own business and the politics of that. And then also the union, I'm really troubled by the Electrical Union. Their history, I think you know what I mean by that. And so there's a
sure.
lot of
no, Frank,
nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we hear. Well, and let me ask about the money
sure.
part, because there are, if you're running as a candidate, you are limited by the rules and regulations in Philadelphia.
Well, some people are, but other people aren't. So
well,
let me just say to
But there are these outside groups that yeah. Frank was referring to.
Oh, yes. I've spoken out about this. I had a news conference and put out a paper about it. Frank, the mayor's office is not for sale. It should never be for sale, and it should never be perceived as for sale. I have asked every other candidate to sign a pledge not to take what's called outside money or dark money from these PACs that are not accountable to the voters. I am abiding by the campaign finance reform rules, which limit campaign contributions to a certain dollar figure for, as a maximum, and being scrupulous about campaign reporting. I believe that the Campaign Reform Committee made a horrible error and left it open for the mayor and every other office in Philadelphia to be appear to be bought or paid for by these outsider groups who are unaccountable, unknown, not named, and have a tremendous amount of influence on the potential outcome of the election by not being required to reveal who the names of the PACs are, who are the constituent members of the PACs, limiting their money, or at least saying who the donors are and why they're giving this money. So the two groups that you referred to are obviously, in my judgment, and I've said so, trying to influence the outcome of this this election improperly. The Campaign Finance Reform Committee should stop it. I believe that a mayor cannot be expected to be not in the hip pocket of some special interest if they're putting up $5.5 million or $3 million or whatever the million figure is to influence the outcome of this election. And I'll tell you what, Frank, I believe the voters are going to reject those people who have all that dark or outside money attached to their campaigns. And I understand the Supreme Court has spoken on it, but our ethics reform should cover every dollar that comes into every campaign account for whatever office, and especially the mayor's office.
Frank, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost up in a break here. How much money have you raised so far, Lynn?
I'm not going to tell what I raised because I'll be reporting it on April the 29th or 30th, the day that it's be required. But it'll all be public. It's all on public record. We don't hide campaign reports. They'll all be published when everybody puts up their campaign reports.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation.
Except for the dark money interest. They won't put that out.
And that's Lynn Abraham. She wants to be the mayor of Philadelphia. And again, the May primary is on the 19th. I should add that, yes, we've been focusing a lot on the races here in the city of Philadelphia, but we should say this is a Pennsylvania primary. If you live outside of the city, you get to vote as well, and you have your own candidates and your own issues as well. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation with Lynn Abraham, one of the six Democrats running for mayor of Philadelphia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Lynn Abraham about why she wants to be mayor of Philadelphia, the first of what will be six interviews with Democrats, all of them running to be the mayor of Philadelphia. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at, what is our tweet? At WHYY Radio Times. I want to try to understand something here. You'd had an interview with Patrick Kirkstra a couple of months ago for Cityfied, and you said, I am already on record about the decriminalization of marijuana. Mm. I'm against it, especially for kids.
Right.
Then I went to your policy page under crime and public safety, and I read that you support decriminalization of the possession of small amounts of marijuana for personal use. Lynn does not, however, support decriminalization for children and adolescents. I mean, I don't think anyone wants children or adolescents
exactly right.
to be using drugs. So are you in support of decriminalization of small amounts?
For small
or
amounts
not?
For adults. Yes, for adults. Not for children, because as it, the documentation of medical science is absolutely right. plain that when children and adolescents use drugs, their brains not having been fully formed, which everybody agrees to because that's the right. way our brain develops, the effect on the cognitive and psychological factors in the brain are devastating. And so I believe that children should never be taking right. illicit drugs.
Whether, and what's your definition of children? Is it 18, 21?
Well, adolescents are anyway up to 18.
Okay.
So after – the fact that one is an adult and one has possession of small amounts of marijuana should 18 and older.
You're okay with decriminalization?
Oh yes. Now, and I'll tell you.
Is that a change position for you?
Well, it's somewhat changed for this reason. During my time as district attorney, we had a small amounts of marijuana program, so that if you had an ounce or more, you went into a diversionary program, and you went through the program, and at the end of that time, your record was expunged. The real issue is what's happening now is that rather than spend police amounts of time to take those young adults off the street and process them and do all that, it was just time-consuming and not worth it, and especially when those folks were not involved in other criminal activity. In other words, if I were robbing a bank and had a small amount of marijuana on me, we wouldn't prosecute you for the small marijuana. It was the bank robbery. So I think we even go further than some of the others. I don't believe that any police officer should give anybody a ticket or a citation. First of all, because when you're doing it on the street, you don't know who the person really is. Number two, if the person decides not to pay a $25 fine, is the city of Philadelphia going to spend, you know, $10,000 trying to find you for $25? And what if they do? What are they going to do with you in? Bring you to court? No. This is just silly. If you're going to decriminalize.
So if a cop sees a 19-year-old smoking a
– police officer going to walk right by,
just
I guess.
Walk by.
Oh, yeah. I think the police officers – you can tell by the statistics. The police officers are walking right by. And I don't think that's a – bad thing, assuming that there's nothing else afoot, and that I mean by doing something like beating somebody up and having a marijuana joint. That the marijuana was never the issue.
So do you agree with Jim Kenney on this?
Well, I agree only in a certain part. He believes in the decriminalization. I think I'm not saying this incorrectly. You'll have to ask him. But I said that for adolescents and children, no, I don't agree with him, not at all. I believe that the evidence is quite clear that children who engage in risky behavior as a general rule,
sure,
even to the point of taking synthetic drugs, which skirt all of our laws, is so dangerous and so hurtful to the brain that we should have a very strong rule against that and offer those kids who have these problems help, treatment if necessary, interventions, prevention. Understanding how the brain works, if you tell kids this is really risky, kids don't think that this stuff is risky. If you show them how dangerous this is, most, not all, but most will say, you know, I don't think so. This is too risky. I want to go to be a doctor. I can't do this if I'm smoking joints or taking illicit synthetic drugs.
I always thought you were a big supporter of the war on drugs as it has been described, which is
I have been,
which has been in many ways the criminalization of
no, it
of
has not no 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 no
use.
It wasn't that no what it was the killing of thousands of people in Philadelphia over drug turf and over major drug trafficking organizations, all of which are violent. Some kid smoking some adult smoking a marijuana cigarette is not the war on drugs. The war on drugs,
but isn't that who ended up in our prisons and jails?
Not the kids and not the
drug dealers?
No. I mean, the drug we concentrated our efforts as a prosecution's office on major drug trafficking organizations. Virtually all of the murders in Philadelphia involving drugs were for that reason, fueling the war between this gang and that over drug turf and profits and who got the drugs and how much. So this was a major driver of violent criminal behavior which tore apart the city. Little girls sitting on their front steps being killed by mistake. Moms, you know, in the kitchen, a bullet comes through the house because the war went outside of their windows. The citizens of Philadelphia demanded that the police department do this, and the prosecutor's office responded to what was happening, which was a wholesale murder and maiming of thousands upon thousands of people of Philadelphia's cities on their very street corners.
But has that changed? I mean, in certain ways, the war on drugs, we are in a much less violent country than we were 25 years ago, and that the war on drugs has had this unintended consequence of putting people in jail, separating families.
I quite understand that, and obviously when the violence goes down, that's a great thing because people don't resort to violence. Our homicide rate goes down. The fabric of the community is better. People are working longer. I totally support that, but I am worried about the influx of many drugs still, which we'll have yet to see what will happen when more people invest in these designer drugs that are really very dangerous. But look, right now we're in a great place. Our city's on a roll, having great things happen. And I think there's greater days ahead for Philadelphia. And I'm delighted that the crime rate has gone down. That's a reflection of our maturity and moving past these bad elements.
We have a Facebook comment from Pat. Is there anyone from the current Nutter administration that you would like to keep on? Will you ask Charles Ramsey to stay on as police commissioner? Is there anyone from the current Nutter administration that you would like to keep? Have you thought that far ahead?
I have. Mike DeBernardinis of Parks and Recreation, Rob DeBow, our finance budget director, and obviously Charles Ramsey if he wants to stay. Mm. I don't know. I haven't spoken to any of these people, and they're probably shocked out of their socks that I've mentioned their names today. But these are just
– they're on notice, right?
Well, as of this moment when that person asked me, yes, except for Ramsey, to Commissioner Ramsey. I've spoken about him before, but not Mike DeBernardinis. I would have kept Rhina Cutler. She is a gem, but she's leaving us for SEPTA.
Let me get Raphael from we have two Raphaels. Let me get the Raphael from Germantown, if I can put it that way, on the air. And Raphael, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how you doing?
Good,
I was wondering if Ms. Abraham would be in favor of asking Governor Wolf to reinstate the $200 cash benefit that you would get from public assistance, with which Governor Corbett cut off.
The answer is yes.
It's a poverty issue.
Yes, the answer is yes,
and,
Raphael.
Oh, okay, because I happen to be on disability, and when Social Security disability, and when he cut off that $200, it literally crippled me.
You know, I don't know what Governor Corbett was thinking about when he did that. This is a matter of human dignity. True human dignity. And I would certainly I don't believe I'm going to have to ask Governor Wolf. I think Governor Wolf is going to do this of his own accord. But if for some strange reason he doesn't do it, I will.
Raphael, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me try for Sarah. And Sarah is calling us from Cobbs Creek. And Sarah, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Ms. Abraham.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just had a very quick question about police accountability. So, Ms. Abraham, you spoke a minute ago about things that you claim you would do to reform the police department, and you specifically mentioned excessive force. And I'm just wondering why anybody should trust you to hold police accountable when they abuse their power, when, in addition to your poor record on that as district attorney, since leaving the DA's office, you've been a partner at a law firm, Archer & Grainer, that routinely defends police officers who are accused of violating people's rights and abusing them, including until withdrawing 5 days after you announced your candidacy, they withdrew from representing the 6 narcotics officers who are currently facing criminal charges for just a laundry list of abuse of power.
Well, Sarah, thanks a lot. I can tell you that in our system, Sarah, whether you like it or not, everybody, you and I, Marty, Moss Cohen, and everybody in this world is entitled to an attorney. I don't think anybody would want to say that a person in our country is not entitled to legal representation. Who my firm represents is nothing to talk about, because I don't talk about our clients or who we take on or who we don't represent. We are in a law firm, and our lawyers make judgments on whom to represent. But anybody is entitled to representation, A. B, with regard to police abuse, I have arrested and prosecuted many police officers for brutality, for excessive force, for killing citizens, for shooting citizens, for excessive force, for corruption, and for a whole variety of other offenses. And my record, I stand by it. And the record is there if you don't agree with it. That's your opinion, and I'll stand by my record, and you can stand by your opinion. But I do believe everybody's entitled to a defense. That's what our Constitution provides, and I think our Constitution of the United States and Pennsylvania are two pretty terrific documents.
Sarah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, and again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And again, Lynn Abraham is our guest in this hour of Radio Times, one of 6 Democrats running for mayor of Philadelphia, and we have scheduled interviews with all of them. There is a perception, and I'm picking up on Sarah's call, and you were called, you know, I think it was Frank Rizzo called you one tough cookie.
Yeah.
I know that you've been in favor of the death penalty, mm-hmm. but the idea that you're sort of a law and order type person, maybe that's not a bad thing.
Do we want no law and lots of disorder?
No, I believe it's not
a bad thing to be a person who believes that a civilization functions better when everybody is peaceful, nonviolent, and trying to, you know, just go along, make a living, do well. I don't mind being called tough because in running this city, you really have to be strong. The problems are so great. The obstacles so horrendous. The getting from here to there on some of the most simple, one would think, problems. There's no such thing as a simple problem. If it's a problem, it's complicated. You have to be strong and resolute and directed and independent and thoughtful and get to where you need to be. You have to be strong and tough and resolute. I'm all of those things. I'm proud of that. And I, you know, if I were a man, you'd think that was a great, you'd think that was a great thing. For women, I don't know, there's a double standard, but I embrace that name. That's a good name. I am tough. And you can't be in the political field unless you're tough and strong. This is a tough business. Ask Hillary Clinton. She'll tell you.
Indeed.
She'll tell you a thing or two.
She's getting her dose. Let me get Chris from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very
I really
welcome.
Appreciate it.
Sure.
You know, I am probably slightly right of center, but I'm not extreme in either direction. And Ms. Abraham, I appreciate your stance on a lot of the issues. But my question is this. Philadelphia has been governed by Democrats for many, many years, and I'm reluctant to say that it's viewed on as it's not a great city compared to Washington and Philadelphia. I'm sorry, and New York and the like. So my question
depends
is
who you're talking to there, Chris. But go ahead with your question.
So my question is, how can that change? No. It's not depends on who you're talking to, Ms. Boscoin. It's a fact that's been played out for years. So my question is, how can this change? Because I really want to see the change, because Philadelphia is a fantastic city, and I want it to change for the better. So
okay.
how can you change the tide of policies that have been put in place in the past? Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. Chris, thanks for the call.
Chris, I appreciate that. The question is not what party I belong to, but where my brain and my heart and my whole direction is going. We were a one-party city before the Democrats took over. We were totally dominated by Republicans. When the Clark Dilworth era came in, over the course of time, we flipped the pancake, so to speak, and we became a totally Democratic city today. There was a transitional period, of course. So the best way that a city represents all parties, or two parties, if you will, whatever, is that people who believe follow the Republican philosophy, whatever that means, they can register Republican. But right now, Philadelphia is dominated by the Democratic Party to an extent about 7 or 8 to 1. So I don't believe party label has never meant a lot to me per se, except I'm a Democrat and I embrace the ideals of the Democratic Party and the ticket. But I believe when you govern, you don't ask whether this is a Republican way of thinking or a Democrat way of thinking. You say, what is the right thing to do under the circumstances? And you go ahead and do it. If you're labeled a centrist or a rightist or a leftist, who cares? It's what are we going to do to make this city? And what am I going to do? What's my vision to make this city the next great American city where the mayor is nobody's mayor but yours, the public's? That's my goal and my dream.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but just picking up on that question there, but wouldn't the city be better off if there were two, I don't care what you call them, but two parties that really battled it out in a primary?
I don't know if the city, quote, would be better off. It's how we govern, which is important. Would it be more desirable, perhaps, if we had representatives of, let's say, more parties or the other major party in this country, the Republicans? It would be a very nice thing to occur. But if our populace is not hewing to whatever their view of being a, quote, Republican is, we're going to stay Democrat. And as far as I'm concerned, as a Democrat, I'm going to ride the wave. If people want to change, God bless America. This is a great city and a great country. Thank you, Marty.
Lynn Abraham, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. She is running for mayor of Philadelphia. The first of what we have scheduled, 6 interviews, all the Democrats running for mayor in this city. I should add that tomorrow our guest is Doug Oliver, also wants to be mayor of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Also check out Newsworks. We've been doing a lot of, they have been doing a lot of coverage of the mayor and council races here in Philadelphia. Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.